why does a state have a policy that says state parks have to pay for themselves? Dumb, dumb, dumb. This is Jim DeBacchus on the left.
Utah gets an unlikely limelight from an unlikely source, our Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox. I'm Dan McKay on the right.
Senator Clinton's shortlist, who's on it? This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Natalie Gochner. But first, this news. Good morning, I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center, and I am in the studio representing the political right, Dan McKay.
Good morning.
Representative, always nice to be with you, and State Senator Jim DeBacchus on the left.
Good morning.
And this week, I'm just representing the University of Utah campus with the visit of His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. And I was on campus the day of his visit, and there were just all these people. It was just crowded, and I hadn't kind of put my thumb on what was going on. And then I realized that the Huntsman Center had this kind of magnet of people just walking up there, marching up.
Is this the second or the third time the Dalai Lama's been to the U?
I'm going to guess the third. I know of two, and I think I missed
one. I thought it was
one.
A third. Yeah, I've been to two now, and that's why I was assuming there was a third as well. So
yeah. So give me some color commentary. I mean, Jim, have you met with His Holiness before?
Well, met is a too strong word. I was in the room where he
spoke.
That's
pretty good. That's pretty good.
Once.
How big of a room? That's what we got to qualify.
It was a hotel room. Okay. I mean, a hotel ballroom.
Not, I was going to go like hotel room with beds in it or hotel? How about you, Dan? You have any personal stories with the Dalai Lama?
Yeah, well, I served my LDS mission in India and Nepal.
Wow.
And while I was there, my companion and I made a point of trekking out. So we had... Our mission was a little bit different. We had six-month visas. So every 6 months, we had to leave India and go somewhere to get a new visa. And that usually took a month to go and get a visa. And so during that time period, we literally were tourists in Nepal because proselyting wasn't permitted in Nepal. So the first time I went, we were tourists. We had nothing else to do. And a month before that, I had met Mother Teresa and thought, wow, this is amazing. And so I thought, well... why don't we try and meet the Dalai Lama? And so we did. We went out. He didn't answer the door, but I thought it was
cool. How many 19-year-olds get to go, have that kind of an experience?
Wait a minute. I'm not buying this. What kind of a mission is it? Every 6 months you go to the south of France and wait for a month to go back in? Well, if word gets out, this could be a very popular request.
That's the best mission call on the planet.
It was the best mission call because I got to do India. I got to do Nepal. I got to do Malaysia, Singapore, China. You
serious.
Know.
Did you feel his, his strong presence, his goodness?
Yeah, he is a very strong personality, right? It's amazing. People, I mean, in Utah, we don't know a lot about Buddhists, right? But having served my mission in that part of the world, I know a lot more about them. But it is a lot liberating. It's really liberating when you care about, when your religious philosophy is focused solely on the spirituality of the individual and not necessarily on one person being right or wrong.
Yeah.
It's really liberating, and you always feel that from the Dalai Lama when he speaks or when he talks. He doesn't really care what religion you are as long as you're getting, your spiritual center nurtured. And it's really, really amazing because he's not even really, The time I heard him before, his statement was more along the lines of, I don't even care if you believe in God.
Mm-hmm. Just right thinking, right conduct.
Yeah, be moral, be true to yourself and nurture that inner self and that kind of thing. It was really...
it's a beautiful thing.
Really, really good.
You know what I love is that some of the proceeds from his visit, they all go to charities, but he gives some to the Primary Children's Hospital, which I thought was terrific.
Well, and I saw a picture of online and he was wearing a U visor.
Yeah, we love that. Now, just kind of making the transition from what the Dalai Lama does with his money to Donald Trump and his money.
Boy, there's a leap.
His campaign reports are a little troubling, Jim.
Wow. I mean, this...
he might be the first guy running for president that makes money doing it.
This... Enid Green may turn out to be the most important woman in the country coming up shortly. You remember the former Utah congresswoman, really bright, above-table woman, mm-hmm. who had an unfortunate husband selection. So she is the co-rules chair, and there is a growing movement among the delegates to change the rules to allow a vote of conscience, I guess a vote of religious liberty, which would allow delegates, whether or not they are committed to a candidate on the first round. And there are now hundreds who have been contacted and dozens who have said, yes, I will vote for that. And the cascade that came down yesterday was Mr. Trump had raised somewhere around $1.3 million in May. And just to put that in contrast, Hillary Clinton was around $68 or $69 million. Mitt Romney, in May of 2012, had raised $83 million. And 20% of all of the money that Mr. Trump has raised so far has been spent on his golf courses, his jets, his water companies, his own personal
probably catering
projects.
Companies, yeah.
It just seems to me that the situation is, if I'm a Republican, it's preposterous, and I don't know what
Boy,
they're going to do.
If I had the opportunity, I would place that vote of conscience, Dan.
Well, and it's going to show. I mean, you've seen him fall off the map in a few key states now, as far as polling is concerned. The money situation is going to be a problem because when people know that the candidate is paying themselves, it becomes a real problem that people don't want to give you money.
Mm-hmm.
And it's somewhat, in my mind, it is a real conflict for Donald in this situation. But nobody should be surprised.
You know what's saved him, in my judgment, is the smart political move to put out his Supreme Court list of picks.
Yeah.
Really helped him. So it'll be interesting to see when the VP decision comes, how that starts to change things. Washington Post has an article showing the short list for Hillary Clinton. Now, there could be more names on it. And, Jim, you seem to think you have some insight there. But Elizabeth Warren on the list, the Massachusetts senator, the secretary of HUD. Is it Julian Castro? And then Timothy Kaine with Virginia, senator from Virginia.
Warren is not going to be selected.
I love a two-women ticket. But.
No, it is. I think people at the head of a ticket do not want somebody with a stronger personality mm-hmm. and a bigger flash than they do. I think.
Do you have a prediction there?
Yes, I do.
Let's hear it.
It won't be Warren. The good senator is very conservative. And he would be completely the wrong choice to unify the Democratic Party. Kaine, from what I hear, even money or better says it's going to be the senator from New Jersey, Cory Booker.
Mr. Booker.
Yeah. He's a good one.
See, I was going to say, I didn't hear him on the list, but I'm with Jim. That's who I think Hillary's VP is going to be.
Okay.
I think it's running away. It will be Cory Booker.
Yeah. How about on the Trump side, Dan? Do you have a short list in your mind?
No. Mia Love.
I've told him I'm not available. There are several.
Maybe James Evans. I mean, he seems to
be buddied up.
Kind of cozy.
No, I don't know. I hate this campaign season.
Yeah.
I'm so frustrated. Everything about this campaign season is everything I dislike about politics.
Yeah. I have a column in the current edition of Utah Business where I write about drift and mastery, and I talk about how this campaign season's drift for me. I'm just waiting for the next one so we can get back to mastery.
Yeah. Well, I'm praying it's not more drift. I mean, that's the thing.
I understand.
The trend is for more drift.
What about we heard that Marco Rubio is going to enter the Florida Senate race.
It was announced finally. He is in.
That's the thing. I mean, he's going back on his word there, but
yep.
I guess you just forgive him for that, Dan?
Oh, no question. No question. The guy ran a presidential race, and he was frustrated with the Senate. I get that. Everybody gets frustrated with the Senate. And at the time that he thought he wasn't going to run simultaneously as being the president, he wanted to show that he was throwing his hat over the fence. It didn't work out. There's nothing wrong with him jumping back in.
Jim, any quick comment on Rubio back in?
No.
Well, are we going to talk about the governor's race?
Let's do it in the next segment.
Okay.
Let's do it in the next segment. So Jim DeBacchus on the left, Dan McCann on the right, Natalie Gochner in the political center. In the next segment, we will talk about the Utah governor's race.
Mm-hmm.
Bakas, proudly on the left.
This is Dan McKay, sheepishly on the right because Jim might beat me up.
Natalie Gochner in the political center, and I hold the peace in this room. This is both sides of the aisle. Let's talk about the Utah governor's race. And I don't want to admit it to our producer, but every once in a while I listen to KSL, and it's like one ad after another. It'll be hirejj.com, you know, Jonathan Johnson, and then you'll hear Gail Miller speaking on behalf of her endorsement for Governor Herbert, or Mike Leavitt. I mean, it is – you can tell that the real gubernatorial election is happening right now. We're inside a week before the primary election, and it's getting kind of interesting. And in recent weeks, we've had something interesting happen with the lieutenant governor, Spencer Cox. We spoke about this last week. He spoke at a support group for the Orlando victims and had just this marvelous speech that went viral. And NPR covered it, and it's just been our lieutenant governor really showing his talent.
Well, Spencer is a very talented individual, and I think anybody that underestimates Spencer finds themselves quickly changing their opinion, right?
Yeah.
Because he is a not only is he intelligent, bright, and all those other things, but he's very strategic and intelligent about how he approaches himself and his and the public persona. I think he rivals Ben McAdams in some ways.
Yeah.
Ben does a very good job of that as well. And I would say those two going head-to-head in a race would be very, very interesting because the two of them handle themselves so well.
Yeah. Young, publicly. Talented, strategic.
Young, talented, all those things. And so I figured, and I think I've told you this before, it was only a matter of time before Spencer did or said something that showed this brilliance.
That got him on the national
stage. That got him,
even.
Yeah, that got him some national exposure. I'm not surprised.
Jim, you were there when this talk happened, but you're a...
Yeah, I wasn't invited to speak, by the way, Jim. I'm a little bit upset by that.
How do you read this dynamic between Spencer's sort of all this attention he's been receiving and right in the middle of a gubernatorial race?
So it went viral. New York Times, ABC News, Le Monde, everywhere in the world. And I happened to know, because they called me for a phone number, that the New York Pride Parade wanted Mr. Cox to fly back and be one of their grand marshals.
And I said,
well, good luck with that. 2 weeks before the Republican primary, my guess is he's going to be scheduled away doing
breaking
something.
News here on both sides of the aisle. Grand Marshal of the New York Pride Parade.
Yeah, that he had a very important alternative thing. You know, it brings in an interesting dynamic, though, between presidents and vice presidents, between governors and lieutenant governors, and that difficult job of being a vice or a lieutenant, where a lot of times there are many staffers on the primary politician side that outrank you. And, you know, it's very awkward. Natalie, you've been there. You've been in those corner offices. I mean, you probably know a lot more about it than I do.
Well, I think the most interesting thing I watched was once Governor Leavitt chose to resign and take a cabinet position, I watched the transfer of power from one to the other and just watched how that affected the staff and how someone's viewed. Mm. And yeah, that was a fascinating experience for me to learn about power. But, you know, Leavitt and Walker had a marvelous relationship. Every once in a while it would flare up. But I do think that it's interesting to – I mean, I think it's interesting that we're a week before the primary and we're talking about the lieutenant governor and the governor instead of the governor's challenger. Yeah. It just shows you what a big lead Herbert has with a 38-point lead.
Why?
Why does he have the lead?
I mean, when you really look at the big issues, I'm not seeing any kind of a debate. I'm seeing these peripheral little dinky things that don't matter except to a hardcore group of delegates.
And like Common Core.
Common Core would be an example, and just crazy little issues, and no one is talking about the vision of where we're going to take the state over the next generation. It's like it has to get down to the lowest common denominator, and consequently, I think we have a state without a vision. because there can be no vision. A vision irritates people who are in the extremist part of the Republican Party. They don't want it.
When you won't debate someone, it's hard for this kind of dynamic to come together. And Dan, are you – I mean, how do you, why isn't Herbert willing to go to debate Jonathan Johnson and you know, stand up for what he believes and share that with the public? I mean, I know that there's a campaign reason not to do it. He's got a 38-point lead. Why bother? But it's not the right thing for the public.
From a campaign perspective, there's no question, right?
Mm-hmm.
You never, as a sitting incumbent, you never want to be in a position where you have to appear on stage with your opponent because it only legitimizes your opponent.
And it's a risk.
It gives, yeah,
something
it gives them equal footing, that kind of thing. So I wanted to talk about the campaign reason. But I am really lamenting, though, that the public isn't frustrated more about that.
Mm-hmm.
Because like you've talked about before, campaigns need to be about ideas. They need to be about vision. They need to be about goals and not about people.
Mm-hmm.
Right now we have a campaign about people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm good or no, I'm gooder. And it's mm-hmm. this back and forth on who's gooder on certain things, mm-hmm. right? And I know mm-hmm. gooder's not a word.
Mm-hmm.
But so just save the listeners from calling in to correct the Republican on the gooder. But I predicted a few months ago that this would devolve into a high school student body competition.
Mm-hmm.
And sadly, that's what this has become between the popular kid and the unpopular kid. And, you know, the polls kind of show that. The unpopular kid may have some valid points, but no one's ever going to listen to him because, you know, we're not going to put their ideas on an equal stage and have you choose between them. I do regret that. And this is one of the first gubernatorial or statewide elections where we have seen no debate. And everybody says, well, they did debate, but they debated at 7 a.m. in a hotel with no TV cameras.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? That was the debate.
Yeah.
That doesn't satisfy public discourse. And I think it cheats the public out of what ought to be done in campaigns.
Well, and it wouldn't be so bad if we weren't such a heavily dominated Republican state. But because we are, you know, there's really very high likelihood that the Republican wins. And so in the primary, you need a debate so that you have the choice between two Republicans.
Yeah, and people talk about...
I'm sorry if that's offensive, Jim, but it's just sort of this fact to me that... That in a Republican primary for governor, those two Republicans got a debate.
Offensive.
I'm kind of with, you know, we do have you know,
some similarities.
We have Jim Light today, but I'm with Jim.
I took an Ambien at 4 o'clock this morning, and I shouldn't have because anyway. So I'm.
It's great. I get to win today. This is fantastic.
And,
no, so but I am disappointed. Candidly, I like Governor Herbert, but I am disappointed with the campaign tactic.
Yeah.
Winning over policy conversations.
You know, I work at the Kempsey Gardner Policy Institute, and we, along with the Hinckley Institute, hosted a candidate conversation this week with Mr. Tang and Congressman Jason Chaffetz. It was a really nice – it was hosted town hall style where Jason Perry did the Anderson Cooper kind of thing, and we just gave each 45 minutes. Media was there. It was a great thing. I was really impressed with this Mr. Tang.
I love his orange drink.
It's E-N-G.
I've heard he's actually a really bright individual.
He was impressive.
Yeah,
I mean,
very impressive.
Congressman Chaffetz is the same, but those two are talking. And
yeah.
We extended the invitation to the Herbert campaign. Couldn't get him, so then we couldn't extend it to the Johnson campaign because it's not happening.
Why? Why does the media and groups say no? You invite both of them, and if one of them says no, you give them your forum, as big as it is. That might be the kind of thing that would pressure people to actually show up.
I agree.
It's an interesting point. You know, the Deseret News has been hard on Herbert on this, editorializing and being upset that he won't debate, but it is what it is.
It won't be enough. It
won't.
There is – the biggest problem is – and the press is trying to create the clamor. You and I, we're sitting here. We're sitting in the radio. We're trying to, you know, create the clamor. There's no clamor.
Yeah.
The public is not upset about there being no debate. And the reason they're not upset about there being no debate is they have something else to do.
Well, I was going to say they're pretty happy.
They're pretty happy.
The economy's good. They're fat, sassy, and happy, and they're just not going to engage here.
Yep.
It's one interpretation.
Jim, give us the other, or...
They're cynical. They think no matter what happens, it doesn't matter. That the fix is in. That it doesn't... That makes no difference where they go.
So they're even beyond.
The gerrymandering has been so profound and so deliberate that it just doesn't matter. Republicans and Democrats think that way. When those Republicans get in at the turn of the decade and they bring out those supercomputers, it just doesn't matter. And there's a lot to be said about that.
So last Friday, we had our former Governor Mike Leavitt take the whole day off, and he went to Lehigh and Pleasant Grove and Payson and Roy and walked neighborhoods with Count My Vote candidates. These are candidates who use the signatures to get on the ballot. I think it was a terrific experience for Governor Leavitt. He enjoyed meeting the candidates and going door to door with them. Jim, do you think it'll help?
No.
Tell me more what you're
seeing. I don't think the Republicans have enough. I don't think there's going to be that much pushback. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just the small fringes that are upset. I think it's going to be run on the merits of the campaign.
In the Count My Vote crowd, what they're seeing is these very hostile Republican Central Committee parties, both in Weber County and Utah County, actually giving money to Republican candidates who are facing a Republican primary. So they're giving money to the candidate that they want from the party, even though they're both Republicans.
And they're doing it because they played game with the party insiders and didn't go down the signature route. I mean, that's what we're talking about. Whatever their ideology, this is such a last-ditch kind of clinging to power by the party bosses who love to get into those back rooms with their cigars and smoke filled and little chessboards and mm-hmm. move around and say, this is we're going to decide everything. That leads to an ugly process, and it leads to a lot of people who just turn off to the whole process. Yeah. That's how we end up with a clown like Mike Lee with this kind of back end maneuvering.
Dan, I'm a Count My Vote supporter, so I have to thank you for sponsoring the bill, because we have more choice, more candidates, more competition. I already think Count My Vote has a victory, because the choices happen.
I feel like if you look at the way things are playing out in the state, I feel like this is a good experiment, and it's been a good meaningful change that people are at least, whether they like the compromise or not, Natalie, mm-hmm. they're at least talking about it.
Yeah.
It's at least an issue, and it's at least something that people are considering in elections and involving people for the first time. And I got to say, I think the preliminary results actually look pretty strong.
Yeah. Well, anytime you can open up the ballot and have more choice and more competition, that is good for government. It's time for us to go to gripes, and I think I better go to you first, Dan, so Jim can kind of let's wake him up here. But
I know what will wake him up.
Okay, let's do it.
So this week it is the arts. What is it? The arts festival. You know, here. I thought we'd already killed the arts. We completely defunded them.
There we go.
We've done everything else. I thought we'd completely whacked them, and they've taken over this plaza, and it was really hard to get on this plaza this morning for the KCPW. So if I have a gripe, it's very simple, is that the arts still exist because they caused this inconvenience today. But I'm only saying that really as a straw man to fire up my friend Jim.
There you go, Jim.
Everybody come. Thursday's free because the state slipped $240,000 in. You can come free. It's the 40th anniversary. All weekend is the Utah Arts Festival. Come. I want to talk, though, about one of the most mindless and damaging state policies we have. It is the official state policy that our state parks have to pay their own way. That's it. Uh-huh. They have to pay their own way. And you should see the charts. So the amount of money for our state parks has gone from $12.8 million down to under $5 million since 2008 in actual dollars. And boy, are they proud. Those people from the state parks are busting like, yeah, we're making... You know what? State parks are not profit-making centers, and they ought not be. And the latest example, one of the most magnificent places in our state, the Edge of the Cedars Museum, is in danger of closing along with four other state parks. You know why? Because they're not paying their way. Well, gentlemen, soulless masses, sometimes state parks won't pay their own way. And sometimes it's better with the things we've got to do to make them pay their own way that they not be required to pay their own way. Stop this policy.
Well done, Jim. Dan, I feel like you usually
Ambien wore off.
Usually you follow him and you're like, oh, how do I give my gripe after that?
That's great.
You know, my gripe is going to be purity tests in political parties. And I think that people have the right to self-identify with the party that matches their ideology. I read the Republican Party platform recently. I'm in agreement with it. I don't have any problems with it. I self-identify as a Republican, but when a political party starts to put me through litmus tests and purity tests to say whether I'm the one that they want to give money to within their party, I think that's just wrong. That's my gripe, and I've seen it in two of our counties, both Weber County and Utah County, are just doing things that I think are unfair to fellow Republicans. Ronald Reagan wouldn't like it. I'll just say that. You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I've been joined by Jim DeBacchus on the left and Dan McKay on the right. Programs produced by Ross Chambliss. Thank you for listening.